Good morning. Welcome back to Business for Breakfast. I'm Jimmy Sangenberger. This morning, want to start our tremendous guest lineup this morning with David Bahnsen, who returns here on Business for Breakfast. He's the founder, managing partner, and chief investment officer of the Bahnsen Group, a bi-coastal private wealth management team with offices in California and New York City. They've got over $1.5 billion in client assets. David has been named consistently a top financial advisor in America by Barron's, Forbes, and the Financial Times. He's on cable news, guest extraordinaire, in fact, CNBC, Bloomberg, and Fox Business. He's also on the board of directors for the National Review Institute, has written for the National Review and numerous other publications. And he's got a brand new book coming out in just less than a week, actually. It's entitled The Case for Dividend Growth, Investing in a Post-Crisis World. And we'll primarily be talking about this book this morning. Pleased to welcome back to Business for Breakfast, David Bahnsen. Sir, good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning, Jimmy. Good to be with you.
Hey, congratulations on the forthcoming release of the book. What's the actual date it's coming out?
Well, the release date is April 9th, so that's next Tuesday. The book has actually been number one on Amazon in pre-sale in terms of all investing category books for over a week now. So all those pre-order people are going to receive it in their mailbox.
Go
on
for
April
it.
9th.
Go
yeah,
for it.
Pretty fun.
Absolutely. Well, I've got a copy in front of me. We'll get to that in just a moment. I just want to ask you a couple of economic topics, and then we'll dive into the case for dividend growth. First of all, this China news that we're hearing, is this just more of what we've been hearing over recent months where we've heard this tidbit, oh, we're just about to a deal, and we just got a little bit of the ways there, and the markets maybe get a little bit excited about it, and then, nope, we need more time, that kind of thing, or is there something there, do you think?
Well, I mean, I don't want to say there's nothing there in the sense that we certainly are closer to the end than we were a month ago and 2 months ago. But the specifics that are needed to intelligently price what the outcome will be are still lacking. The odds have moved dramatically higher than they were a couple months ago for a deal being better than we had expected. And what I mean by that is, funnily enough, by the way, and this is coming from China, the issue that I think would most boost markets at this point, meaning there's been a huge move up in markets and a lot of it is related to just the idea that the tariffs are not going to get worse, that what President Trump had been threatening near the end of 2018 is not going to come to fruition. So that's the biggest needle mover. And I think that's been well priced into markets. You and I have talked about that on the show several times. Right now, though, the little piece that is still kind of lingering is the Chinese saying, hey, we would like to give you what you're wanting on intellectual property theft enforcement. And yet what we want in exchange for that is even the first round of tariffs to come back off. And I've remained pretty steadfast in my belief that that has not been priced in yet by markets. So that this is the final piece that they're fighting through, is how can the U.S. get happy with the enforcement that is necessary and in order to throw this final bone out in the deal. And the people I'm talking to say it's getting pretty close.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see if there is some meat on the bones when it comes to the intellectual property discussion. So we'll be watching, of course, very closely. I also wanted to get your thoughts because I know you're friends with and through the committee for, what's the committee with Steve Moore?
Unleash Prosperity.
Yeah, Unleash Prosperity. Yeah. I'm sorry. It escaped me for just a moment. The committee to Unleash Prosperity. It was on the tip of my tongue. What do you make of Steve Moore as a pick for the Federal Reserve Board of Governors?
I knew you were going to ask me.
I had to.
I really am very, obviously I'm involved with this committee. Steve Moore and Larry Kudlow are very best friends, and Larry has been a close friend of mine for a long time. And in the case of Steve Moore, I really think he's been a great public policy pundit. I think that the work he did with Club for Growth and then subsequently with Heritage, some of his writing when he was at the Wall Street Journal, was all outstanding. And frankly, some of the stuff that has come up this last week to try to block him means nothing to me whatsoever. The idea that there's been a dispute with the IRS over a tax bill and they've gone back and forth. It isn't like he's being accused, by the way, of tax evasion. There's been a dispute, and who knows what is really behind that, and an old thing with an ex-wife and stuff like that. I don't care about it. I don't think anyone really does. It's meant to kind of obstruct. However, I do personally have an issue with the idea that one was so strong and resolute that we needed sound monetary policy and strong dollar policies when President Obama was in office, and yet now has decided that the need of the hour is much weaker monetary policy, softer, more accommodative. There could be arguments on the merits one way or the other, but what it does seem to me is that there's been kind of a political reconciling here for Mr. Moore as opposed to an economic viewpoint. Now, all that to say, the Fed has always had, some people that are more dovish and other people more hawkish. And Steve Moore would be a fine person to be on the Fed Board of Governors. But do I think there has been some inconsistency in his public presentation of what monetary policy ought to look like? I would candidly tell you I do.
What do you think about his insistence and your other friend Larry Kudlow's insistence that the Federal Reserve should begin reducing rates?
Well, again, I think on economic merits, I'm perfectly fine with an argument around it. And in Larry's case, he is at least doing us the favor of rooting it in a particular position, whether one agrees with it or not. His position being that right now inflation expectations are so low that it doesn't make sense that the Fed would have been tightening into the fourth quarter, and that to pull back that very last rate hike would be more in line with their present viewpoint. And I think that the credit markets would say, based on the way that the bank loan market spreads blew out here in the first quarter in response to that final rate hike of the Fed, that, you know, there's a plausible argument for it. I'm not in favor of it in the sense that I don't think cutting rates right now makes sense when you haven't even got to your rate objective to begin with. If they want to pause because they believe that they were getting ahead of themselves in what they were doing with money supply and credit access relative to where we were in the economic cycle, it's a legitimate argument around pausing. But I think that cutting at this point risks undermining the messages the Trump administration has been so vocally presenting, which is that economic growth is strong. Why would we cut rates in the midst of economic growth? So I don't see it as a necessary. I frankly think that the consequences to a cut would be worse than they seem to understand.
You know, one thing that I love about having you on the program, David Bahnsen, is that you are intellectually honest, of course, in your approach. You're always going to be. I know that, but I've been learning that for sure, regardless of what your particular friends or mentors might be saying out there in the world of economic and political discussions, in part also because reasonable minds can differ. I agree with you, but I do think that, Larry Kudlow certainly coming at it from the perspective in regards to inflation, that does make some sense from a economic standpoint.
Well, and I'll tell you, the fact that Larry and I may have a disagreement on this particular issue, Larry would not have it any other way that I
believe it.
Say exactly what I believe, and he's one of the happy warriors in our cause, and so, you know, the reasonable people can disagree on certain things. Larry too, though, is going to end up, addressing this issue, because if it's rooted in the issue of inflation expectations, 3 months ago, Jimmy, oil was at $44, all right? It's now at 62 on WTI, 69 on Brent. And so you're gonna get to a point where even the inflation argument starts presenting data that forces a bit of rethinking.
Yeah, that's a great point. All right, let's dive into the book. The Case for Dividend Growth Investing in a Post-Crisis World. I got a copy right in front of me, and you can go check it out online on Amazon. Make your purchase today. I really like a couple of things about it, David. First of all, it's not a long, extensive read. It's also not confusing. In fact, it's written out in a way that is very easy to follow with a point-by-point process, even among the chapters, all helping you get to the next phase in the discussion. And so I always appreciate especially when we're talking about issues that can get complex in terms of really significant strategies on investing and so forth, that this, I think, really does a good job at breaking that down. So I want to lay the scene for everybody with what you talk about in the introduction, which is a lost decade in U.S. equities from the first decade of this century that really sets the stage for the post-crisis attitude that you talk about throughout the book.
Yes, and so I think that there is a important history of people that manage money, people that kind of analyze economics and so forth, that they tend to contextualize their viewpoints around the era in which they grew up. And there's a lot of folks, Paul Tudor Jones is this real famous hedge funder, very macro-oriented guy, commodity-centric. And to this day, he always writes with a heavy theme around inflation. And I think it's very healthy, very informative. But you notice he grew up in the 1970s. He cut his teeth. He became a billionaire investing in an inflationary period of the 70s. And I use that as an example because I think that all of us do that to a certain degree. And I began my life as I was already an investor in the 1990s. I became a professional investment manager in the first 10 years of the new millennium or new century, in which it was bookended by the dot-com crash at the beginning of the decade, and then bookended at the end of the decade by the Great Recession and the financial crisis. And so we can argue that neither of those events will ever take place again, let alone both of them in one decade. That's fine. I'm not particularly sure why someone would have a lot of confidence that they wouldn't. I don't think you could argue that no type of crash or no type of drop would ever take place again. We certainly think business cycles continue, even if you're content to believe that there won't be any superlative drop. There certainly would be recessionary periods that we've had throughout history. And so if an investment strategy one is using did not work or would have acted, and I don't just mean because, you know, the portfolio values went down. I mean, if actual financial goals were undermined, if the success of one's retirement plan was taken away by, let's say, just withdrawing from the S&P 500, which a lot of people do through that period, why would one believe it is now all of a sudden a sustainable plan? And so what I have tried to do with dividend growth and this book, The Case for Dividend Growth, is make the argument that throughout the lost decade of 2000-2010, one withdrawing in their retirement from growing dividends would have gone down in value. Their stock prices would have dropped more so during 2008 than during 2000, but nevertheless, they would have suffered through both recessions, but their income would not have suffered. Their withdrawal rate would not have suffered. Their path to restoration of portfolio value would have been far, far, far quicker. And yet, here we are today with most people just back to owning 5 mutual funds or 5 ETFs and believing just to hold the stock market, withdraw from it, and everything will work out for good. And I happen to think that if you're just simply talking about how the stock market will perform over time, it will. Over 20 years, I expect the stock market to be higher. But if you're withdrawing from it when it is declining, you risk what is called negative compounding, and you can do permanent deterioration to your value. And that is what the book seeks to address.
Now, you're not just talking about find a stock that will appreciate over time, but also give you a steady dividend. You're talking about more than that when it comes to dividend.
I sure am, and that's a great distinction. I'm talking about a company that is growing the dividend over time because the company is paying a nice, attractive dividend like a utility, but not growing it. The problem is it sends a signal that there could be operational problems in the company. And first of all, if they are growing their profits over time, there is no reason for them not to be growing their dividend. And if they aren't growing their profits, then why do we want to own the stock? We're not getting paid for the risk that we're taking. And so people, I have a whole chapter in the book dedicated to this. And I believe, by the way, it's going to end up being the number one thing people talk about, because I, for 20 years now, have encountered the misunderstanding that we're talking about high dividend stocks as the core of our thesis, as opposed to growing dividends. Very often a high dividend just simply means the company is broken, that the stock price has dropped so much that as a yield, you know, let's say you have a company that's at $100 stock price paying you $5 a year in dividends. So it's 5%, right? But then the stock drops in half. Now it's $50, but it's still paying you $5. So you go, oh, wow, it's a 10% yield. That looks like a great company. But in reality, it's just simply an accidental high yielder. Mm-hmm. The stock moved down 50%. And the vast majority of the time, those companies will end up cutting their dividend if they stay in business at all. And so we are looking for companies that are growing their yield organically, the right direction, not because the stock price is dropping, but because the cash flow of the company is growing.
Talking here on Business for Breakfast with David Bahnsen, good friend of the show, author of the new book coming out next Tuesday, The Case for Dividend Growth, Investing in a Post-Crisis World. Something else that you talk about in terms of the dividend is not necessarily just accumulating that and just letting that grow, perhaps, but at times reinvesting the dividend. What does that mean, to reinvest the dividend?
So most companies in America pay their dividend every quarter. They might be on different calendar cycles. Like some companies might pay January, April, July, October, and others might pay February, May, August, November. You get the idea. But the point is that they pay regularly. And as those dividends are being received, for someone who doesn't need the income or need the cash flow, they're just automatically reinvesting those dividends into more shares of the stock or the company that is themselves paying it. So you are receiving the compounding benefit of getting more value added in the very instrument that is paying that income itself. So it's sort of compounding within compounding. Not only do you get the compounding of your share price growing through time, year over year, which is what most people think of as compounding, you're getting extra shares fitting into that process from dividend reinvestment. And the one of the great reasons that I advocate this for accumulators is because of the reality of market volatility. All those dividends that we're reinvesting in the fourth quarter of last year when the market had its hiccup, we're reinvesting at lower prices. You were creating an automatic dollar cost averaging, even if you didn't intend to, and it enables your cost of ownership over time to be far lower, because you get to benefit from the, you know, various dips that inevitably take place over time. And so the reality is, for a dividend growth investor who has a long time till they're going to need access to the capital, someone accumulating wealth, it actually makes sense to root for your values to stay lower because you're accumulating more shares at lower prices. Now, that's not going to happen. Good companies through time are going to be growing. But the dividend reinvestment, if you go back far enough, see, in one quarter, it barely registers. In 1 year, not so much. 2-3 years, it starts to add up a bit. But when you look over a longer period of time, the fact of the matter is that the bulk of money people make comes from dividend reinvestment.
David Bahnsen, our guest, just about out of time, but we'll continue talking about this book in our forthcoming conversations. We'll have you back in a couple weeks. We'll dive into some other aspects. But I just want to ask you, in terms of the book, as folks are picking it up and taking a look at it, what do you really want to get across the most from the read?
What I really want, regular investors, you know, people at home that are not professional investors, but really have significant personal financial goals and are looking for a cogent, intelligent, rational way to manage their downside, but also achieve their financial objectives. I want them to see that a sort of just lazy, passive, blind, hold the whole market and everything works out okay approach has not always worked out. And the fact that we've now had a decade since the financial crisis where it did work out has numbed a lot of investors to the reality of the first decade of this century. Dividend growth has provided a solution to that in every decade we can go back to the Great Depression. It's provided offense, it's provided defense, and most importantly, it's what real investing is actually about. You actually get to buy real companies with real profits, paying real dividends and cash flows. That's what we believe investing ought to be, and that's what the book is about.
The book is The Case for Dividend Growth, Investing in a Post-Crisis World. It is not a massive read. You can get through it pretty darn easily, too. Great descriptions and explanations of the issues involved. The author, of course, is good friend of the show, David Bahnsen. David, look forward to talking more about the book. Great read, and best of luck with it.
Thanks so much, Jimmy. Really appreciate it.
You bet. Again, David Bahnsen, the book, The Case for Dividend Growth. Check it out on Amazon. Comes out next Tuesday. I'm Jimmy Sangenberger. We're going to take a break.